every neighborhood has its oddballs. Those quirky individuals who catch your attention but never seem dangerous. Robert Berdella was one of those people, eccentric, mysterious, but seemingly harmless. To his neighbors, he was a talented cook and a peculiar antique dealer with a passion for collecting oddities. But no one suspected that the same man who charmed customers at Kansas City's flea markets was also a sadistic predator. What created this dichotomy? How did a quiet, bookish child become a name etched into infamy? The making of Robert Berdella, the Kansas City Butcher, is a journey into the complex web of personal tragedy, societal pressure, and a mind descending into darkness. In this episode, we uncover the foundation of Robert Berdella's life, examining the societal, familial, and personal factors that played a role in his transformation. We'll explore the seemingly ordinary milestones, childhood, family dynamics, education, that, when looked at closely, reveal troubling patterns. Berdella's story isn't just about the crimes he committed. It's about the cracks in the framework of his life that allowed his darker impulses to flourish. This is Scarlet Tavern. All right, back with season three.
Welcome back, everyone.
Hope everybody had a great holidays, a great new year. We want to thank you if you are returning to us, and welcome if you are brand new. If you have returned to us, you are going to possibly hear some stuff that you heard before. Just tweets. We're giving you better quality, more information, better flow. Basically fixing everything that we fucked up in the first season.
Hopefully it's a better flow. Hopefully.
So, yeah, we just want to give you guys better quality. We did have a lot of quality issues at the beginning because we were recording remotely. Mm-hmm. So now that we're recording in person, it's going to be a lot better. So basically, as these come out, we are going to remove the older episodes as each one comes out. So season one is going to shorten significantly. And half of this year will be spent redoing these episodes. And then we have some brand new stuff that we're going to be doing towards the middle to the end of the year.
And this season, I'm hoping we can make it a little bit longer, not cut it short.
Also, on the plus side, from where we, a better position where we began, we have more and better alcohol for me to consume, although it is still annoyingly out of arm's reach.
You are banned from alcohol while we're recording, and you know why.
I do not recognize this. This is, I do not recognize this new rule.
Yeah, so we are going to continue or start with Robert Berdella. So this was our first episode ever, also our biggest episode ever, the one that got the most listens and the most views, probably just because of how much of a piece of shit he is.
Honestly, he's also probably one of our more gruesome, sadistic ones we've done. And we've hit a, as you all know, we've hit a very very topic of, you know, killers and subjects and everything, but this one always stood out as just bad.
I'm just gonna say, I knew it was bad, and you guys told me it was bad, but I didn't think it was that bad until I did the research into it to write it. And I'm like, oh fuck.
Just remember, we offered to do this for you.
Yes. So, all right. Let's get into it. This one is close to home. Well, at least starting out.
Listener discretion advised.
We're not going to name what...
I'm not going to say listener discretion advised because that's all of our episodes. This is a true crime podcast. If I also need to say that, you should not be listening.
Also, we're not going to go into specific. It's just all bad.
Yes, we are.
Part two, we go into details.
Have you not read at all any of this?
Do you not remember Robert Bredella?
Oh, I remember Robert Bredella.
We go into detail.
Oh, I know. Details of the murders.
I'm just not going to tell everybody what specifically to look out for because, again, it's just all bad.
So, we go to Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio, which for us, that is just outside. It's in between Akron and Cleveland.
Yeah, about
it's
three.
Just north of Akron.
Yeah, about 3 hours or so from us.
So it's not that far from us. Robert Bredella was born there on January 31st, 1949. It was a quintessential American suburb, emblematic of the post-World War II era. The town's ethos centered on hard work, family, and conformity, traits that were celebrated in the industrial Midwest. For many, Cuyahoga Falls offered stability and the promise of upward mobility. For the Bredella family, however, the picture-perfect ideal concealed underlying dysfunction that would profoundly impact Robert's development. Robert was the first child of Robert Bredella Sr., a die setter at the Ford Motor Company, and Mary Louise Bredella, a homemaker. His father's job was grueling, demanding long hours and a meticulous attention to detail that left little room for emotional connection at home. Mary Louise upheld traditional homemaker responsibilities, focusing on creating a structured household. Despite her efforts, the family's dynamic was often strained with high expectations and limited emotional nurturing. Discipline in the Bredella household was strict, reflecting the broader cultural emphasis on order and traditional values. While this environment may have provided structure, it also left little room for emotional growth or individuality. Robert Sr. imposed authoritarian expectations on his sons, emphasizing traits like physical strength, athleticism, and competitiveness, qualities that young Robert struggled to embody. Robert Sr.'s approach to parenting left a lasting mark on his eldest son. A man of few words but high expectations, he demanded conformity and adherence to the traditional notions of masculinity. His disappointment in Robert Jr.'s lack of athletic ability and introverted personality was palpable, often expressed through harsh criticism or outright dismissal. Robert Sr.'s inability or unwillingness to celebrate his son's intellectual and creative accomplishments created a rift between them. For young Robert, his father's approval felt perpetually out of reach, fostering a deep sense of inadequacy.
Probably because his dad was probably just too dumb. Yeah. He didn't like the fact that his eldest child probably was smarter than him.
Yeah.
It comes more down to that his father wanted a good boy, good old boy's boy,
mm-hmm.
doing athletics and stuff like that, which we'll get into more further down. But he didn't like that his son couldn't do that for health reasons.
Mary Louise attempted to mitigate the harshness of her husband's discipline, often acting as a buffer between father and son. However, her efforts were limited by her adherence to traditional gender roles, which place her in a subordinate position within the household, in the kitchen.
Fuck you.
Hey, it's where they were back.
It's the time period. Her place was in the kitchen.
I know.
Doing laundry, doing all of that stuff. That was her place.
By the way, honey, can I please get a sandwich?
Remove the crust.
Please.
Where's my people opener?
While she provided some emotional support, her inability to counterbalance her husband's authoritarian parenting left Robert Jr. feeling unsupported. This lack of affirmation from both parents compounded his feelings of rejection and isolation. In 1956, the family dynamic shifted with the birth of Robert's younger brother, Daniel. From the outset, Daniel exhibited many of the traits their father valued, including physicality, athleticism, and sociability. The stark contrast between the two brothers deepened Robert Sr.'s disappointment in his eldest son, who he saw as a failure to meet the standards of traditional masculinity. Daniel became the clear favorite, receiving praise and attention for his achievements, particularly in sports. Meanwhile, Robert Jr.'s academic successes and creative pursuits were overlooked, further emphasizing the divide. The consistent comparison between the brothers left Robert feeling alienated and resentful, he began to view his younger sibling not just as competition for parental attention, but as a symbol of his own perceived inadequacies. And we state this, Robert Berdella Jr. had almost a genius level IQ. He was a very smart person.
Oh, yeah.
It was just his social ineptness that made him who he is.
It's sad that those...
Again, like we always say, like we said constantly, nature versus nurture.
Mm-hmm. It's sad how oftentimes that those two things go hand in hand. You got a genius level person, but they got the social skills of a pear.
That, but... babe?
What? What are you all looking at me for?
I'd say the social skills of a pumpkin, but...
Yeah.
Anyways.
I have good social skills.
Wait.
I don't know.
Talking to who? Yourself doesn't count.
Damn it.
The voices in your head don't count.
Damn it, that's all I had going for me. Shit.
The unequal treatment planted the seeds of deep-seated resentment and a yearning for control. Robert's inability to compete in his area, in the areas his father valued, forced him to seek validation elsewhere, often through solitary pursuits where he could excel without judgment. From an early age, Robert faced significant health issues that set him apart from his peers. At just 5 years old, he was diagnosed with severe nearsightedness, requiring thick glasses that became a defining feature of his appearance. These glasses, coupled with his reserved demeanor, made him an easy target for ridicule and bullying. He also struggled with speech impediment that made communication difficult, further isolating him socially. His condition left him vulnerable to mockery, heightening his sense of otherness. High blood pressure, an uncommon diagnosis for children, added to his physical struggles, reinforcing a perception of fragility and weakness.
The glasses thing, I can tell you, kids are fucking mean.
He had like Coke bottle glasses.
I didn't have Coke bottle glasses, and I was right around the age Robert was when he got diagnosed with nearsightedness. I also have nearsightedness, but... kids are freaking mean. I got called four eyes and all of that, like, consistently.
That's why I resisted. I mean,
you still resist to get glasses. Let's be honest.
Honestly, and a lot of it is rooted in the fact that when I was a kid, especially grade school level to middle school, I was relentlessly bullied, and my mom, my mother, and my dad was like, "You need glasses, Ben. You need glasses. You can barely see. All that squinting's gonna hurt your face." And I just wouldn't do it. Put my foot down because I was just not going to give them more fuel for them to make fun of me.
And now, how old are you and you still refuse to get glasses even though you squint severely to read consistently?
At this point, I'm just used to it.
At this point, it's cataracts.
Yeah.
Fuck you.
Robert's health issues prevented him from engaging in many of the activities that other children his age enjoyed. Sports, games, and outdoor adventures were often off limits, leaving him excluded from the camaraderie and social bonds these activities fostered. Instead, Robert turned inward, finding solace in intellectual and creative pursuits like reading, drawing, and cooking. These hobbies became an escape from the harsh realities of his social and family isolation. Tell you right now, if D&D existed back then, he would have been a D&D player.
Probably. Oh, yeah. That's what I was just thinking. I was like, I wonder if D&D would have made him better or worse.
Probably better. I mean, he would have found friends.
Now, actually, given how his father was, he probably wouldn't have allowed it. And
he would have hit it. He would have done it at school. Mm-hmm. He hid everything else he did. Yeah. So he would have hid that, too. If Gary Gygax, why couldn't you have been born 20 years earlier? The Berdella's family devout Roman Catholic faith played a central role in shaping their household. Weekly mass attendance, religious education classes, and adherence to strict moral codes define their daily lives. Robert Sr. of Italian-American descent was particularly devout, instilling a rigid sense of morality and discipline in his children. This religious framework added another layer of pressure on young Robert, whose actions and thoughts were scrutinized through the lens of Catholic teachings. While the church provided a moral foundation, it also created an environment where deviation from societal norms was heavily stigmatized. For Robert, who later struggled with his sexual identity, this rigid framework became a source of internal conflict and shame. The expectations of faith often clashed with Robert's burgeoning awareness of his differences, fostering feelings of guilt and fear that he carried into adulthood. And, I mean, that's common with Christianity as well.
Those types of strict religious households. I mean, even in Islam, even Hinduism, there's just a very strict adherence to the norms of the religion that bleeds into how the family should be. I mean, Jesus.
I mean, even coming from a non-denominational aspect of me when I was in my teen years, that strict adherence was horrible because anytime you thought a bad thought, you thought you were going to go to hell and shit like that. Tell me about
it. Or even in we've probably seen it in a number of sitcoms that host anybody of Indian, like South Asian descent, Indian Hindu faith. There's just that strict, I can't shame my family, I can't shame my parents if I do anything that's like outside of what they did when they were younger. And I mean, a lot of it is really just the strict religious background. It doesn't really matter which religion it is. It all has its same
drawbacks.
Exactly.
The combination of bullying, parental favoritism, and strict religious expectations forced Robert to develop a stoic exterior as a means of self-preservation. He learned to internalize his frustrations, presenting an outward image of compliance while harboring anger and resentment beneath the surface. This detachment became a defining characteristic, enabling him to suppress his emotions and focus on activities where he could exert control, such as cooking and art. Even as a child, Robert exhibited behaviors that hinted at his later tendencies. His need for control and his fascination with systems, whether through recipes and cooking or the precision of art, reflected an early desire to impose order on a world that seemed chaotic and rejecting. These traits, while benign in childhood, would later manifest in darker ways as Robert sought to assert dominance over others. Robert Berdella's early years were marked by rejection, isolation, and internal conflicts. While these struggles alone do not explain his later actions, they created a fertile ground for the development of destructive behaviors. His childhood set the stage for a life marked by a quest for validation and control, traits that, when coupled with a lack of empathy and a growing fascination with dominance, would lead him down a path of unimaginable horror. As Robert Berdella entered adolescence, his academic talents became increasingly evident. Teachers recognized his aptitude for analytical thinking, creative problem solving, and a meticulous attention to detail. He excelled in subjects like science and art, often standing out for his intellectual curiosity and determination to succeed. However, his academic prowess did little to mitigate the challenges he faced socially. High school was an unforgiving environment for a boy like Robert, unathletic, physically awkward, and introverted, and ugly. His thick glasses, speech impediment, and reserved demeanor made him a target for bullying and ridicule, further deepening his sense of isolation. He was not a pretty kid.
No, he was not. I've seen pictures.
Rather than finding validation in his achievements, Robert felt alienated as his intellectual successes failed to garner the attention or admiration he sought, particularly from his father. The teasing and harassment Robert endured from peers compounded his feelings of inadequacy and rejection. Classmates mocked his appearance, his lack of athletic ability, and his awkward social interactions, reinforcing his belief that he was fundamentally different and unwelcome in their world. His retreat into solitary activities like reading and drawing further cemented his status as an outsider. These pursuits, while intellectually enriching, left him without the social connections or support systems that many of his peers relied on during their teenage years. During his teenage years, Robert began to grapple with his emerging sexual identity. Realizing he was gay in the conservative Midwest of the 1960s was a profoundly isolating experience. Homosexuality was heavily stigmatized, and societal norms dictated strict adherence to heterosexual relationships and traditional gender roles. The teachings of the Catholic Church, which condemned homosexuality as a sin, added another layer of guilt and an internal conflict. For Robert, his sexual orientation was not just a private matter, but a source of shame that placed him in direct opposition to the values of his family, faith, and community. To maintain the appearance of normalcy, Robert briefly dated a girl during his teenage years. The relationship, however, was superficial and lacked genuine emotional connection. This attempt at conformity only served to underscore the growing chasm between who he was and who he was expected to be. Unable to openly express his feelings or explore his identity, Robert internalized his frustrations, adding to the simmering resentment that would later characterize his adult life.
Oof. This is just, you can already see everything starting to boil and simmer.
Yeah. By adolescence, Robert's relationship with his father had deteriorated further. Robert Sr.'s expectations of physical strength, athletic ability, and the traditional masculinity remained unmet, fueling his disappointment and disdain for his eldest son. Robert Jr., in turn, grew increasingly resentful of his father's favoritism toward his younger brother, Daniel, whose athleticism and sociability embodied everything Robert Sr. valued. The constant comparisons between the brothers deepened Robert's feelings of inadequacy and rejection. And by all accounts, Daniel was a star athlete. Multiple sports, very popular, like dating the cheerleader, blah, 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 blah.
You think at this point, Robert Bedella Sr. would just leave his oldest son alone, like, whatever. You clearly didn't work out as what I wanted to, and just focus on Daniel, which I mean he did, but it seems like he's
gonna let you in on an abusive father. Guarantee you, every time Daniel did something great, in not so many words, he would put down Robert Jr. consistently. Parents' favoritism towards one child is horrible.
Oh, I'm
sure. Know how you fix that? Be an only child.
Yeah, well, fuck you both. I'm the only one that has well. Now you do.
Mary Louise continued to act as a buffer between Robert Sr. and Robert Jr., but her efforts were largely ineffective. While she provided occasional emotional support, she lacked the authority to challenge her husband's authoritarian parenting style. For Robert Jr., his mother's inability to shield him from his father's criticism and favoritism further compounded his sense of isolation within his own family. Cooking became one of Robert's earliest passions and a vital emotional outlet during his teenage years. In the kitchen, he found a sense of control and creativity that eluded him in other areas of his life. Experimenting with recipes and techniques provided a structured and rewarding escape from the chaos of his family and social environments. This interest in cooking also reflected Robert's need for precision and order. Following recipes allowed him to impose structure and predictability on a world that often felt overwhelming and unpredictable. Art became another refuge for Robert, allowing him to express himself in ways he could not through words or social interactions. Drawing and painting provided an outlet for his emotions while also allowing him to develop a skill set that earned occasional praise from teachers and classmates. His fascination with art extended beyond creation to include an interest in cultural artifacts and historical objects. This passion would later manifest in his business ventures as a flea market vendor specializing in antiques and oddities. And again, by all accounts, he was actually a great artist and a great cook. A voracious reader, Robert immersed himself in literature, often gravitating toward darker, unconventional themes. Books provided an intellectual escape and a means of exploring ideas and worlds far removed from the realities of his daily life. His reading habits also reflected his growing interest in control and power dynamics, themes that would later play a significant role in his crimes. And the books I read, then. Serial killer. As Robert matured, he began to question and reject the authoritarian structures that had shaped his upbringing. His father's strict discipline and the rigid moral framework of the Catholic Church became sources of frustration and defiance. This rebellion against authority extended to societal norms as well. Robert viewed traditional expectations of masculinity and conformity with disdain, seeing them as oppressive and hypocritical. Mm-hmm. The combination of bullying, familial rejection, and societal alienation fostered a deep cynicism in Robert. He began to view the world as inherently hostile and trustworthy, a perspective that would inform his interaction with others throughout his life. The cynicism also fueled a sense of intellectual superiority. Robert saw himself as different, smarter, and more creative than those around him. This belief only deepened his isolation as it prevented him from forming meaningful connections.
That's another dark turn of that genius-level intellect.
By the time Robert graduated from Cuyahoga Falls High School in 1967, he was eager to leave behind the environment that had caused him so much pain and frustration. High school had been a battleground of rejection and isolation, and Robert saw graduation as an opportunity to reinvent himself. His academic achievements, while overshadowed by his social struggles, provided a pathway to higher education and the possibility of a fresh start. Seeking independence and a chance to explore his creative passions, Robert enrolled at the Kansas City Art Institute, KCAI. The decision to move to Kansas City marked a turning point in his life, offering a glimpse of freedom and self-expression. For Robert, KCAI represented more than an academic opportunity. It was a chance to escape the oppressive environment of his childhood and begin anew in a place where his talents and interests might finally be appreciated.
And just to let the his father actually passed away shortly before he went to KCAI.
Yeah.
Mm. You think at that point he would? I wonder if he even went to the funeral.
I believe he did. And it compounded a lot of mitigating factors with his father that he went even more in depth into Catholicism.
Really? I would have thought with his father dying, he would have been like.
I believe he was away from his family when it happened, and when he got back, he was told his father died.
Yes, so he was already in Kansas City when his father died.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they didn't tell him until he was back home.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is having like a great family.
Robert Burdella's teenage years were defined by a series of conflicting forces, his intellectual and creative potential clashing with the rejection he faced from his peers and family. His desire for self-expression stifled by societal and religious expectations, and his yearning for acceptance overshadowed by a growing resentment toward the world around him. These years laid the groundwork for the traits that would later define Robert as both an adult and a criminal. A deep need for control, an obsession with power dynamics, and an ability to compartmentalize his emotions in a way that allowed him to mask his darker impulses. By the time Robert entered adulthood, he was already an outsider in many respects. His experiences of rejection, isolations, and internal conflict had shaped a personality that was both deeply introspective and increasingly detached from the norms and the values of the world around him. While his adolescence did not predestine him for the crimes he would later commit, it provided the psychological and emotional foundation for the man he would become, a figure driven by resentment, control, and a desire to assert dominance in a world that had denied him acceptance.
Yeesh.
In the fall of 1967, Robert Burdella, once again, left the confines of his conservative upbringing in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio, to enroll in the Kansas City Art Institute, KCAI, in Kansas City, Missouri. This move marked a pivotal moment in his life, offering a chance to redefine himself away from the oppressive expectations of his family and community. Burdella was drawn to KCAI's reputation as a progressive and avant-garde institution. The school emphasized experimentation, creativity, and pushing artistic boundaries. An environment that seemed perfectly suited to his intellectual curiosity and artistic aspirations.
I have a question. I'm sorry if this is going to make me sound stupid, and I'm just going to accept it as, what does avant-garde mean? Avant-garde? I have no idea.
In the case to this, it is, in case to the institution, sorry, it literally means vanguard or advance guard, but it's like experimental ideas.
Oh.
Yeah. So the actual definition, new and unusual or experimental ideas, especially in the arts or the people introducing them.
Okay. I've seen it obviously a whole times before, but I just never really knew what it meant.
Yeah. I had to learn that. It's in Rent.
Yeah.
I talk about it in Rent a lot. So when I did Rent twice. So Burdella's first year at KCAI began on a promising note. Professors noted his meticulous attention to detail and strong work ethic, particularly in mediums like painting, sculpture, and mixed media. His projects often displayed a high level of technical proficiency and conceptual depth. His intellectual approach to art, combined with his ability to articulate his ideas and critiques, earned him recognition among faculty members. He was seen as a diligent, focused student with a bright future in the art world. Despite his academic successes, Burdella struggled to integrate socially at KCAI. His aloof and often condescending demeanor alienated many of his peers, who found him difficult to relate to or collaborate with. KCAI placed a heavy emphasis on group critique sessions, where students were encouraged to provide and receive feedback on their work. Burdella's inability to accept criticism gracefully created tension with classmates and professors alike. He often interpreted critiques as personal attacks, responding with defensiveness or dismissiveness. I know people like that.
Mm-hmm.
This pattern of behavior mirrored the social struggles he had faced in high school, reinforcing his sense of being misunderstood and unappreciated.
I can kind of understand where he's coming from as someone who had to learn not to do this. It's hard. It's coming from his family, because whenever his dad would say something that was a critique, it was legitimately a personal attack, so he never knew the difference between a critique and a personal attack against his person.
Burdella's difficulties with collaboration and social interaction deepened his isolation. While he yearned for connection and validation, his behavior often pushed others away. The cycle of seeking approval but alienating those around him became a recurring theme in his life. Over time, Burdella's frustrations grew, and he began to withdraw from the social aspects of college life, retreating into solitary pursuits and cultivating an air of intellectual superiority.
That's sad.
By his second year at KCAI, Burdella's relationship with the institution had begun to deteriorate. He developed deep resentment toward the administration and faculty, accusing them of stifling creativity and promoting what he saw as narrow-minded conformity. Burdella's critiques of the school extended beyond academies or academics to include broader societal norms. He began to articulate a worldview that was deeply anti-establishment, rejecting traditional authority figures and structures. This defiance extended to his art, which became increasingly provocative and confrontational. Burdella sought to challenge societal norms through his work, often choosing themes that were designed to shock and provoke discomfort. I will say, this is also the time period. This is the early 70s.
Yep.
This is, he joined school in the late 60s, 67. So this would be 69.
Oh yeah, this is the height of the like Vietnam is going on.
So that fuck you government was huge at this point, because remember, they hated the war. They did not want the war happening. We should not be involved in this, all of that. So especially the college kids were very much fuck you.
Well, plus also on top of that, you had
number one, I don't know how he got out of the draft.
Probably his medical conditions. Yeah.
Maybe.
If he's got high blood pressure when he
wears Coke bottle glasses.
That wouldn't have mattered back then. It's not like it is now. Again, this is a draft.
Yeah.
They if you could walk and hold a gun without dying, they were taking you.
He's lucky
he got out of the draft.
Pretty sure it's probably because of his heart issues.
Yeah, I mean,
technically he doesn't have heart issues. He just has high blood pressure, which, I mean, at that time they didn't have blood pressure medication, but a balanced diet can fix that.
Yeah.
Which he did not have.
That's his fault.
Yeah, they didn't really.
That's his fault for being a fat ass.
And
was he fat?
Oh, yes.
Yes, he was.
He was very fat.
And
not like Robert Taft fat, but he was fat.
I believe it was towards the end of it. We'll get more into it. But the end of his first year, the beginning of his second year, drugs. Meth.
Yeah, it was his second year.
Yeah, I mean, also, like you said, Vietnam's going on, civil rights is going on, there's the new movement of women's liberation rights and everything going on. There's everything is upheaval going on.
And then, 4 years before this was the march, it was MLK's march, was 1963. So that was the start of that too.
Yeah.
So you had so many things compounding together.
Yeah, this anti-establishment stuff.
Yeah.
Which is probably why a lot of this today, if someone did what he did, as we're about to cover,
he'd be in prison.
Red flags all over, but it was all kind of covered up in the sense of like we gotta hide it, but it wasn't noticed.
It was
as much.
More of a societal norm.
Everybody was doing everything, so nobody really noticed it.
Putting animal blood on themselves and walking around butt-ass naked in schools, saying that the war shouldn't happen.
Yeah, so, we're just about these things. These are horrible, but I can see how they got missed.
Berdella's shift towards more provocative art was exemplified by several infamous projects that alarmed both classmates and professors. The duck incident. Berdella captured and killed a duck as part of an art piece exploring themes of life and death. He later cooked and ate the duck, claiming the act was an integral part of the creative process. The incident sparked outrage among his peers and led to disciplinary action from the school. All right, what this doesn't say. So, he did this in the middle of the school lawn. He was outside, took the duck, slit its throat in the middle of the school, skinned it, cooked it right there, and ate it in front of everybody. He didn't do this in his dorm.
Jesus fucking
God. Well, he did it out in the public lawn. KCIA has this huge lawn in front of it. I've been there.
Oh, okay.
It has this huge lawn in front of it, and he did it right there.
That in front is
of a bunch of people.
Brought out like camping supplies and cooked right there.
I don't get the art display of this.
It's not.
I mean, it is to him.
Yeah.
In another controversial project, Berdella sedated a dog with tranquilizers to observe its reactions. This act, while intended as an exploration of control and manipulation, was seen as cruel and unethical, further isolating Berdella from his peers and faculty.
At least he didn't kill the dog.
Listen, if he did not kill the dog was taken from him.
Yeah, I hope probably before he could kill the dog.
Before he could slit his throat and eat it. Listen, if he was a veterinary student, that's one thing.
Yeah.
This is, Jesus. But like you said,
welcome to art students. All of them are psychopaths.
Seriously.
Anybody that's involved with the arts.
But honestly, like I was saying before, everybody is doing everything in an experimental, especially in an experimental art school. I can see how this just didn't get, nobody... nobody really is like, oh my God, I can't, we gotta go tell the dean. It's like, yeah.
KCII has been known for
it's
outlandish stuff.
They also did do that too. It went to the dean.
So these projects blurred the line between artistic exploration and pathological behavior, signaling the emergence of Berdella's sadistic tendencies. While some viewed his work as thought-provoking, others found it gratuitous and deeply unsettling.
I bet the people who found it thought-provoking are fucking idiots.
Yeah. During his time at KCII, Berdella became immersed in the vibrant counterculture scene of late 1960s Kansas City. City's art community was a hub for experimentation, not only in creativity, but also in lifestyle and substance abuse. And Kansas City was rampant with LSD. It was a bunch of hippies lived in Kansas City.
And they lived everywhere.
LSD was very easy to get in Kansas City.
Oh, yeah. It was.
So was meth. They had a big meth pandemic at this point.
Really?
Oh, meth.
Oh, yeah.
I thought meth was mostly... I mean, I know meth has been around for since World War II, but I didn't think it was that prolific back then. I thought it was only recently.
It is because of, like, especially in, like, farming communities and stuff like that, farming areas, because certain ingredients are easier to find in those areas.
Yeah, I know now, I just didn't think it was like that back then. I guess I just thought everybody did weed and LSD.
Cocaine's been out longer than meth.
Yeah, but you would think, according to the pop culture, you'd think it only ever started in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, so meth produced by Mexican criminal groups in Mexico, California, and southwestern states. It's a predominant type available in Kansas, although the availability of locally produced meth is increasing. Now, this is obviously now. The number of meth laboratories seized in Kansas more than quadrupled from 98 through 2001. And many law enforcement agencies report that they are witnessing an adverse environmental impact from the presence of methamphetamine laboratories. So,
meth is extremely toxic.
Yeah. So, wow. Meth-related admissions, treatment admissions to publicly funded facilities in Kansas increased from 997 in 1997 to 1,160 in 2001.
Damn.
So in three years.
Jesus.
Yeah, so meth is readily available still to this day throughout all of Missouri, but Kansas City being the largest there.
Kids, if you're listening, don't do drugs. Also, kids, if you're listening, don't listen to this.
Yeah. Don't do LSD and meth. Marijuana, that's your choice.
Yeah.
Because it's not a drug.
I don't know why we're saying kids don't do drugs. Kids should not be listening to this podcast.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Berdella began experimenting with drugs, including marijuana, LSD, and methamphetamine. What begins as casual use quickly escalated as Berdella discovered that drugs provided a means of escape from his frustrations and a tool for manipulation. Recognizing the potential for profit, Berdella began dealing drugs to classmates and acquaintances, using the income to support his habits and finance his art projects. The side business also allowed him to exert a degree of influence over those in his social circle as he controlled access to substances they desired. And this is how he gets arrested for the first time. Berdella's foray into drug dealing revealed his growing interest in manipulation and control. He used drugs not only as a means of financial gain, but also as a way to assert dominance over others. By creating dependency, Berdella established leverage, positioning himself as someone others needed but could not fully trust. In 1968, Berdella's burgeoning drug activities caught the attention of law enforcement. He was arrested twice in quick succession. The first arrest occurred when Berdella attempted to sell meth to an undercover officer. He received a 5-year suspended sentence, which he interpreted as a minor setback rather than a serious consequence. Less than a month later, he was arrested for possession of marijuana and LSD. Unable to post bail, he spent 5 days in jail before charges were dropped due to insufficient evidence. So, the first arrest with meth, that's common. It's his first offense. He's never been arrested before. They're going to let him off easy.
Yeah.
He did get convicted, but his sentence was suspended. So basically they give him a 5-year sentence and give him time served.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's very, I mean, considering at this point they're really trying to crack down on drugs, this is actually very generous.
And then the insufficient evidence.
I don't get that.
The police fucked up the marijuana and LSD. The chain of evidence was fucked.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
I was about to say, it's like less than a month later, insufficient evidence. I'm like, yeah, he should have been sent right to prison.
Chain of evidence got fucked. Chain of evidence is important, people.
Yes, to any current rookie cops out there who might be listening.
First of all, wear fucking gloves when you search somebody. Because if I see you do that and not wear gloves, I'm going to come smack the fuck out of you. Because I cannot stand it.
But yes, also follow your, dot your I's, cross your T's, chain of evidence, very important. Because the way I understand a suspended sentence is that it's almost kind of like a parole thing in the sense of like those 5 years, if you do something like what he did within those 5 years, oh, you're going to prison.
Correct. Depending on the state.
Yeah.
But yes, he could fuck up if he's convicted of, if he was, would have been convicted against of this marijuana. Yes, he would have gone back, gotten the 5 years.
And then additionally.
And then an additional for the marijuana LSD, which would have been another year-ish. Because marijuana and LSD, they didn't care as much about as they did meth.
Plus the fact. Because that wasn't,
marijuana and LSD weren't killing people.
Also, laws at this point, they didn't really, before the 1960s, they didn't really have a drug problem in America in the sense like they did at that point. So the laws were kind of like, oh yeah, just give him like a year if he's got like a bunch of meth and LSD. And it's like, nowadays, but then after they kept catching so many people, they're like, okay, we need to.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is also the center of the hippie movement as well. So marijuana, LSD was rampant everywhere. Fucking they were mixing them both, which in Florida, we actually had a name for that. It was called a wet daddy. You would take marijuana and you would lace it with one of two things, either LSD or PCP.
I've heard of lacing PCP, like people will take PCP and like lace it and try and smoke it.
You'll die. It I have fought somebody on that's been high on a wet daddy. He was butt ass naked.
Oh.
6'8". Big fucking guy. We tased him 6 times. Nothing happened. Yeah. It was not fun wrestling him to the ground. I had to break his knees.
God.
Yeah. Because it was either that or shoot him. And so I broke his knees and he kept crawling towards us still.
It's like a zombie apocalypse.
So then we had to get on top of him. It took 3 handcuffs to handcuff him because he was so big. These brushes with the law only deepened Berdella's anti-authoritarian beliefs. Rather than deterring him, the arrest emboldened his sense of invincibility, reinforcing his belief that he could outsmart the system. By 1969, Berdella's defiance and erratic behavior had alienated him at the KCAI community. His inability to accept criticism combined with the controversy surrounding his art projects led to escalating tensions with faculty members. Facing mounting criticism and disciplinary actions, Berdella chose to withdraw from KCAI before he could be formally expelled. While he framed the decision as a personal choice, it was clear that his reputation at the school had become untenable.
How bad do you have to be to that basically a college of hippies wants to get rid of
this time, yeah, that's all it was. KCAI is one of the premier art institutes at this point, now, but...
He fucked up a lot.
Yeah. I've never even, honestly, before this, I never even heard of this
KCAI.
Place. Yeah, I never heard of
it. You also really haven't been in the arts.
I could barely draw stick figures, so I can't imagine going to an art school.
It costs almost as much as what I'm paying to go to AMDA. Yeah.
Jesus.
And AMDA is, so one year of attendance... 12 to 18 credits, $43,000 plus campus fees and all of that. So you're looking at about $47,000. And I pay significantly more than that. But I also go to one of the best schools in the country. But yeah, KCAI is, it's a very good school.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
Very good. Like, they have animation, art history, ceramics, creative writing, fiber, filmmaking, graphic design, illustration, painting, photography, paint making, product design, sculpture.
Okay, I could see
it going. It is a legit artist.
Oh, thing. Yeah. I could see going for creative writing.
Yeah. But unfortunately, you can get that anywhere.
That's true.
You don't need to go to KCAI for that. You don't pay $50,000 for a creative writing that you can take from the local college.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Especially when it doesn't really affect you. Like, you're not, you don't need a degree on your resume to be a writer, like a book writer.
Yeah.
Where I need AMDA on my resume to be an actor. So Bradella's time at KCAI marked a significant turning point in his life. While he initially saw college as an opportunity for reinvention and self-expression, it ultimately became a period of disillusionment and rejection. His inability to navigate social hierarchies or accept authority left him adrift without the structure or validation he had sought. The provocative art and anti-establishment beliefs he developed during this time foreshadowed the darker impulses that would later define his crimes. Here's the thing. He wants structure. But he goes to an art institute. A place, if you've ever been involved in the arts, there's no structure.
No, I mean, it's,
at all.
It's literally a school that emphasizes experimentation and free pushing around. Yeah. Honest to God, I mean, this is probably true of almost everybody we're going to cover in our show and everything, but Ron Bradella needs therapy. He doesn't know, at this point, he doesn't really know what he wants. He wants conformity, he wants structure, but he hates the authority behind it. He wants this, and that's like, dude, what do you want? Like, literally, it seems like it's very obviously a duh situation, but it really feels like shows that his parents failed him because
he was already shown that his parents failed him on multiple levels.
Yeah, absolutely. And because nobody taught him how to just basically take criticism. It's like, okay, Rob, you need to, you know, fix this, do this. He's like, how dare you? I'm a genius. You're all inferior to me. That really seems like what I'm seeing here.
So, following his withdrawal, Bradella chose to remain in Kansas City, a city that had come to symbolize both opportunity and failure. He moved into a modest home at 4315 Charlotte Street, which would later gain infamy as the site of his atrocities. And for you two, here is 4315 Charlotte Street.
Oh, that's a nice little house.
That is the house that he tortures, rapes, and murders people in.
Ooh, 28 square foot? That's not bad.
That up there,
dude,
is the window that the dude jumps out of.
I would never live somewhere like that, ever.
That's only because you know the history.
Yeah.
Oh, come on, honey. 2,800 square feet is up.
It's off the market. Damn. It's also, they have to reveal that Robert Bradella lived there.
No, thank you. Nope. Not happening. Ever.
Bradella took a job as a short order cook, leveraging his passion for culinary arts to earn a living. At the same time, he began building a side business selling antiques and oddities, laying the groundwork for his future endeavors as a flea market vendor. While outwardly setting into a routine, Bradella's experiences at KCAI had left him bitter, disillusioned, and increasingly detached from societal norms. These years planted the seeds of resentment and control that would eventually manifest in his violent acts. Bradella's time at Kansas City Art Institute was a study in contrasts. Moments of intellectual and artistic promise overshadowed by social alienation, controversial projects, and escalating defiance. The progressive environment he initially embraced became another arena of rejection and frustration, amplifying his feelings of superiority and detachment. By the time he left KCAI, Berdella was no longer just a misunderstood outsider. He was a young man with a growing capacity for manipulation, control, and cruelty. A trajectory that would culminate in a far darker chapters of his life. Again, after leaving KCAI, he moved into a modest home at 4315 Charlotte Street in the Hyde Park District of Kansas City, Missouri. God, I would hate to live there.
Why?
You know how many people probably knock on that door?
Oh, yeah.
To see it?
Oh, God. And unfortunately, the people who would do that are probably
yeah.
already
either. I mean, too. I would do it.
But I wouldn't do it.
The house, a two-story structure with a basement, became the stage for the most sinister chapters of Berdella's life. Located in a quiet residential neighborhood, the home outwardly appeared unremarkable. Its very ordinariness belied the horrors that would later come to light. For Berdella, it was both a sanctuary from the world that rejected him and a space where his darker impulses could be hidden behind closed doors. I wonder how much he paid for that house in the 60s.
I don't think I could find it.
Does it have a backyard?
Probably not.
It does. For the fact that he buried people's heads, I think. Not bodies. In the backyard.
No.
So pretty spacious.
Sure. I'm pretty sure it was in the backyard. I'm pretty sure it was underneath the house.
So.
I thought it was the backyard underneath the tree.
Right now it's worth $358,000. That's the estimated value.
The worst.
No.
I don't want to live in Missouri.
Trying to see if I can see the history of prices for this place.
Oh, I could imagine back then for that, I would probably venture maybe like 50,000, probably more. I don't know. I'm bad at economics. CFO?
I don't think it would be 50,000.
It doesn't say it's something I'd have to research. I could figure it out though. But, yeah, it's off the market. It looks like, I don't even know if anybody lives there, because fucking grass and everything looks overgrown. Somebody probably bought it and was just like, fuck it, I'm not staying here. I got sick of people knocking on my fucking door.
Yeah.
to his neighbors, Berdella was an eccentric but seemingly harmless figure. He often played the role of a helpful and community-minded individual, offering assistance and engaging in civic activities. Berdella was known for participating in neighborhood watch programs and even collaborated with local law enforcement on crime prevention initiatives. These actions further solidified his image as a concerned and active member of the community. His reputation as a quirky but generous person added to the illusion of normalcy, allowing him to avoid scrutiny while maintaining control over how others perceived him. I mean, this goes to Ted Bundy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he would help people to their cars. He would help you with groceries and all of that. And that's how he took you.
I mean, John Wayne Gacy was active in
local. A clown.
Well, he's a clown. Yeah. But
he was a great artist, too.
I am not looking forward to that episode.
He was a great artist.
He's also... John Wayne Gacy was active in the local Democratic Party.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a picture of him and Rosalynn Carter.
Not anymore, there's not.
Oh, it's
still... They tried very hard to remove that.
They failed because I Googled it and it still circulates.
The Googles. In 1982, Berdella opened a booth at the Westport Flea Market. We should go there. A lively and eclectic marketplace in Kansas City. I believe it's still there.
Sure.
Naming his stall Bob's Bizarre Bazaar.
I feel like he should have switched the... It's yeah. Like,
so for those... So it's Bazaar, B-A-Z-A-A-R, and then Bazaar, B-I-Z-A-R-R-E. So it should be switched. Bob's Bazaar, Bazaar. Or was it written wrong?
I'm pretty sure it was Bob's Bazaar, Bazaar.
Well, if he's
already... Yeah, it is Bazaar, Bazaar, but
I'm sure, you know, maybe what?
Maybe he's just that stupid.
Or it's an eye catcher for there. Everyone's like, what? That's wrong. And then you just look at it.
Bob's Bazaar, B-A-Z-A-A-R, Bazaar.
Yeah, he's an idiot.
Yeah.
Well,
this is what happens when you don't finish school.
This is what happens when you do LSD and meth.
That too.
Berdella crafted a business that reflected his eccentric interests and personality. The booth specialized in oddities, antiques, and primitive art sourced from around the world. Items range from tribal masks and carvings to handmade jewelry and unique curiosities. Berdella often entertained customers with elaborate stories of the origins of his items, blending truth with fabrication to enhance their allure. Flea Market provided Berdella with an opportunity to interact with a diverse clientele, further embedding him as a Kansas City's artistic and counterculture circles. First of all, where the fuck did he get the contacts to get these things? We don't know. He never talked about it.
Made it up.
He legit had tribal masks and stuff from all over the world. We have no idea how he got them. We don't know what contacts he got, how he made these contacts. He just magically was able to get all of these fucking ancient things.
Yeah. And the Westport flea market is still around.
Oh, let's go.
I mean, there's flea markets around here I've wanted to go to.
Yes, but none housed a serial killer and rapist. I want to go see Bob's Bazaar Bazaar that's spelled wrong. Wonder if they still have the sign up. I
doubt it.
I would. You know how much interest you would get in people? I'd keep that up and be like, hey, while you're seeing this, go shop around. Mm-hmm. Well, Bob's Bazaar Bazaar spelled wrong.
Not spelled wrong, just in the wrong order.
Whatever. Occasionally turned a profit, Berdella often struggled to maintain the business financially. To keep his inventory stocked, he resorted to scavenging and theft, presenting these items as exotic finds.
There you go. That's how he found all the stuff.
Yeah, but not all of them were. His initial stuff was all legit. Despite his financial instability, Berdella used his charisma and storytelling skills to project an image of success. His eccentric personality and distinctive style made him a memorable figure at the flea market, allowing him to cultivate relationships and expand his social network. Behind the public facade of the helpful neighbor and eccentric vendor, Berdella's home began to reflect his darker inclinations. The carefully curated appearance of his public life masked a growing obsession with control, manipulation, and experimentation. The home's basement and spare bedrooms were transformed into spaces designed for isolation and restraint. Over time, Berdella began acquiring items that would later play a role in his crimes, including ropes, restraints, and drugs. The duality of his existence became more pronounced as Berdella cultivated a world where his private impulses could thrive without interference. Berdella began focusing on individuals who were marginalized or struggling, such as runaway teenagers, male prostitutes, and those battling addiction or homelessness. These populations often lack strong social connections, making them easy to exploit without raising suspicion, him knowing because he was involved. Mm-hmm. Berdella presented himself as a mentor or benefactor, offering food, shelter, or financial assistance to gain their trust. Once trust was established, Berdella manipulated these individuals into positions of vulnerability, using their dependency as leverage to control them. Berdella specifically targeted individuals he believed would not be missed if they disappeared, reducing the risk of detention.
All except for pretty much one.
Yep. Berdella's relationships with these vulnerable individuals often began with acts of apparent kindness. He offered his home as a refuge for those in need, providing a temporary sense of stability and security. However, this generosity came with strings attached. Berdella often framed his assistance as a favor, cultivating a sense of indebtedness that he later used to demand compliance. He gradually pushed the limits of what he could impose on those he helped, using a combination of praise and criticism to destabilize them emotionally. Thank you, Daddy. Berdella discouraged his targets from reconnecting with family or friends, ensuring their reliance on him while cutting off potential sources of support.
Thank you, Mom and Dad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
By the late 1970s, Berdella's relationships with the individuals he took in began to take on darker dynamics. He started testing his ability to dominate others, using subtle forms of psychological control as a precursor to physical restraint. Berdella imposed strict rules on those staying in his home, often punishing minor infractions with verbal outbursts or withholding assistance. He began exploring ways to assert physical control, experimenting with restraints and drugs to incapacitate his targets without arousing suspicion. Brunella's interest in controlling others became intertwined with a sadistic curiosity about pain and suffering. This fascination was reflected in the stories he told and the art he admired, which often explored themes of power, vulnerability, and violence. Brunella's behavior hinted at a burgeoning obsession with domination that would later escalate into acts of physical and sexual violence. He rationalized his actions by framing them as exercises in control, viewing his targets as objects for experimentation rather than human beings. And he'd really like 50 Shades of Grey if it was out at this point.
Yeah, there's a lot of issues as well with 50 Shades. So.
George R.R. Martin books.
Probably more George R.R. Martin.
He would love those. Friggin' incest. The Westport Flea Market provided Brunella with a steady stream of potential targets. Its diverse clientele included individuals from all walks of life, including those on society's margins. Brunella used his charisma and the allure of his booth to attract vulnerable young men. His ability to charm and manipulate allowed him to identify those who might be susceptible to his influence. He often offered financial assistance, employment, or a place to stay to those who seemed desperate or in need, positioning himself as a savior while laying the groundwork for exploitation. Brunella's acts of kindness were rarely altruistic. They were part of a calculated strategy to create dependency and control. Brunella gauged the willingness of his targets to comply with his demands, slowly increasing the level of manipulation to see how far he could push them. He focused on individuals whose disappearances were unlikely to draw attention, minimizing the risk of exposure, except for his first one, because it was literally the son of his friend that was working at the flea market.
His friend.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, it legitimately was his friend. They were friends. He just took to his son. Jeez. By the early 1980s, Brunella's manipulative tactics began to cross into physical territory. He started experimenting with drugs and restraints, testing his ability to incapacitate and control others. These early experiments were marked by an increasing detachment from the humanity of his targets. Brunella viewed them not as individuals, but as subjects in a larger exercise of power and control. This period marked the beginning of Brunella's transition from psychological manipulation to acts of physical dominance and violence. By maintaining a carefully constructed public image, Brunella was able to mask the disturbing realities of his private life. To the outside world, he was an eccentric entrepreneur and community-minded individual. Behind closed doors, he was cultivating the tools and mindset that would lead to his emergence as one of Kansas City's most notorious serial killers. This period of Brunella's life was characterized by the development of two contrasting personas. The outwardly eccentric but seemingly harmless flea market vendor, and the increasingly manipulative and sadistic predator. His ability to navigate these dual identities allowed him to operate undetected, building a life of control and experimentation that set the stage for the atrocities to come. By the time Brunella's dual life was fully established, the seeds of his future crimes had been firmly planted, waiting only for the right circumstances to bring them to fruition.
I believe, like, with the cooking, like him being a cook and everything, he also developed programs that were used and lessons and stuff.
Yes, he did.
They used in cooking schools and stuff like that.
He taught kids how to cook and then raped and murdered them. So Jesus. There's that.
Yeah.
And this whole societal norm thing, we see it with BTK. He was a family man. He had a wife and kids, and nobody knew that in his spare time he was
killing families,
finding, torturing, and killing people. BTK, I believe, is on for later in the year.
It might be.
So, Robert Brunella's childhood and adolescence reveal a man searching for control in a world that seemed intent on rejecting him. His struggles with identity and his fascination with dominance and his early manipulations were all warning signs of darkness that would soon take over completely. But what happens when these tendencies are given free rein? When isolation and rejection turn into deadly quests for control. In our next episode, we'll take you inside 4315 Charlotte Street, the place that would become known as Kansas City's House of Horrors. What happened behind those closed doors would shock even seasoned investigators. Join us as we delve into the crimes, the victims, and the disturbing details of Berdella's reign of terror. And once again, we want to thank you for joining us at the Scarlet Tavern. Please remember to turn in your glasses, push in your seats, and as always, tip the bard. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.